This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Judges at the International Criminal Court have ruled that South Africa failed in its obligations to the War Crimes Court by failing to arrest Sudan's wanted president when he visited the nation for a summit of African leaders in 2015. The ruling comes as South African officials dig in their heels in their decision to withdraw from the court after the controversial incident.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details next. Also, Al-Shabaab militants attacked a police post in Kenya's east coast, killing three officers. And it's been 2 months since Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari was last seen in public. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, judges at the International Criminal Court have ruled that South Africa failed in its obligations to the War Crimes Court by failing to arrest Sudan's wanted president when he visited the nation for a summit of African leaders in 2015. The ruling comes as South African officials dig in their heels in their decision to withdraw from the court after the controversial incident. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
2 years after Omar al-Bashir's whirlwind visit to South Africa, judges at the International Criminal Court unanimously ruled the nation's officials erred by failing to arrest Sudan's president on an international war crimes warrant. The court issued a warrant in 2009 for the Sudanese leader on charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity for his involvement in the long-running conflict in Darfur, where the United Nations estimates 300,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million have been displaced. On Thursday, Judge Kuna Terfusser said the three judges had unanimously agreed on the ruling.
By not arresting Omar al-Bashir while he was on its territory between 13 and 15 June 2015, South Africa failed to comply with the court's request for the arrest and surrender of Omar al-Bashir, contrary to the provisions of the statute, thereby preventing the court from exercising its functions and powers under the statute in connection with the criminal proceedings instituted against Omar al-Bashir.
But the panel said they would not refer the matter to a higher authority at the United Nations. Southern Africa Litigation Center Executive Director Kajal Ramjithan Keo told VOA her legal advocacy group welcomes the ruling, including the decision not to refer the case to the Assembly of States Parties, or members of the court.
A referral to the ASP or the United Nations Security Council would practically have not been of much effect in any case. If we look at the referrals of other similar countries in similar situations, Uganda, Djibouti, Kenya, the DRC, they were all referred either to the ASP and the United Nations Security Council or to both bodies who have taken no action on them. So I imagine South Africa would have been in precisely the same boat. They would have been referred, they would have been very upset about it, and there would have been no follow-through from either of those bodies.
South Africa announced its intent to leave the court in 2015, after the public disagreement with the court over the Bashir incident. The ruling African National Congress Party said last week that it remains committed to leaving the court. Other African nations and the African Union have frequently accused the court of targeting Africans. The court disputes this charge and notes it is investigating situations in a number of countries, but has yet to try a case from a non-African nation. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It appears Kenyan voters will not be able to watch televised debates by the top presidential candidates. Both President Uhuru Kenyatta and the main challenger, Raila Odinga, have pulled out of two televised debates. The first was scheduled for Monday. Officials from the ruling and main opposition party say their candidates withdrew because of a change in how the forum would be held. They say instead of the two main candidates holding one debate and six other candidates holding another, all would be included in a single event. The leading candidates claim that would not allow them to fully address the main issues. The presidential election is scheduled for August 8th. Meanwhile, on Kenya's coast, Al-Shabaab militants attacked a police post yesterday, sparking a day-long gun battle that killed three officers and injured a fourth. Kenya has seen an uptick in attacks over the past 2 months near its border with Somalia. In Nairobi, Mohamed Yusuf takes a closer look at what may be driving the trend.
Police officials say the gun battle went on for 10 hours after armed men raided a police post in Lamu County Wednesday. The VOA Somali service reports that Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack. Since May, Al-Shabaab has carried out a series of deadly attacks in Kenya's northeast and coast regions, which border Somalia. The targets have been security forces. However, a roadside bomb against police vehicle last week in Lamu County also killed four school children. Interior Ministry spokesperson Wendon Joka says the porous border complicates the situation.
We saw many other activities going on the side of Garissa, and I mean, some of these guys moving back to Somalia. But since the time of Ramadan is when we started having the IEDs and all that. So this, the latest incident does not necessarily mean that our agency, the agency forces that are there, have been ineffective there. But occasionally you expect some of these insurgents to make an entry and they cause losses on our side.
He says security forces are enhancing patrols, which may include patrols by air. Some analysts see a link between the fresh spate of attacks and nationwide elections coming August 8th.
They know that everybody is so much focused into politics at the expense of security.
Kenyan security expert Richard Tuta says he fears Al-Shabaab may have been able to establish roots in the Boni forests, despite Kenyan military operations that began nearly 2 years ago to flush them out. The forest stretches from Lamu County into Somalia.
Kenya as a country will start experiencing terrorism being exported, not now from Somalia, but from Boni Authority itself, because it is also acting also as a very good training ground for the jihadists.
The duration of the gun battle Wednesday, as well as the reported number of attackers, as many as 200 fighters according to some Kenyan media, have raised concern. Police have not confirmed the number of assailants. George Musamali is director of the Center for Risk Management in Africa.
From Kiunga, you get into Ras Kambon. We have a whole brigade of the KDF, plus the Somali National Army. So it's becoming very difficult for people to traverse this country and then cross the border, get into Kenya to carry out this attack. So it means basically that these Al-Shabaab guys are actually based in Boni Forest itself. They are not coming from across the border.
However, the Interior Ministry spokesperson told VOA Al-Shabaab does not have long-term bases in the Boni Forest. He said the militants come and go. Kenya sent its troops to Somalia more than 5 years ago as part of an African Union force to defeat Al-Shabaab. The Al-Qaeda-linked group responded by ramping up attacks on Kenyan soil. The most recent large-scale attack in Kenya was over 2 years ago on Garissa University in the northeast. 150 people were killed, most of them students. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Tensions continue to escalate along the border between Burundi and Rwanda. The latest incident last week left one Burundian civilian dead and two kidnapped in the northern province of Cibitoki province. Moses Havyeremana reports from Bujumbura.
According to the Burundian government, one civilian was shot dead by the Rwandan army in Cibitoki province last week, and the other two are said to have been kidnapped by the Rwandan army after what Burundian government called violated the country's sovereignty. At least two Burundians were killed for the last 2 weeks in Cibitoki province at the border between Burundi and Rwanda. Burundi's Foreign Affairs Minister Ali Nyamitwe called on the Rwandan government to release the kidnapped citizens.
We have followed the events over the last weeks and days, and I have to say that it's something that we wish we wouldn't be having at all. Some of our citizens who have been kidnapped, we don't believe that is fair, and we want to live in peace with our neighbors, including themselves, our northern neighbor.
Last week's incident involved several Burundian civilians who were illegally mining gold on the Burundian side of the border. Pierre Nkurikiye is the Burundi police spokesman.
The action of the Rwanda military had the aim to steal the gold because these people exploiting gold in that place killed the one and kidnapped the two and another one escaped.
Last month, 8 Rwandans were sentenced to 10 years in prison for trafficking minerals from Burundi. Bujumbura says that the two Burundians who were kidnapped last week were involved in illegal mining activities on the Burundian side of the border. Rwandan Army spokesman René Ngendahimana says he's not aware of the incident.
I'm telling you, I have no clue on that so far. Let me cross check and I'll come back.
At least 7 have been killed along the country's shared border since last year. They include 2 traders who were smuggling fruits and vegetables to Rwanda. Burundi has banned food exports to neighboring Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo in order to improve food security. And last month, Rwanda said unidentified attackers fired on people and threw 2 grenades in a bar on each side of the border. Authorities say the incident killed 1 civilian and leaving 8 wounded. Counterattacks have been reported between border communities, raising fears and concerns of the security between the bordering communities. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A rights group says it's a mistake for the European Union to rely on Libya to slow the number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean. Amnesty International calls the EU strategy reckless, saying it will put many migrants in Libya at risk. Libya is in the midst of political turmoil and conflict. Criminal gangs often abuse and rape migrants before allowing them to sail across the Mediterranean in unsafe vessels. More than 2,000 migrants have died this year trying to make the crossing. The EU is proposing to train Libya's Coast Guard as part of its strategy to intercept migrant vessels before they enter international waters. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz, on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Seventeen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Judges at the International Criminal Court have ruled that South Africa failed in its obligations by not arresting Sudan's wanted president when he visited South Africa in 2015. Al-Shabaab militants attacked a police post yesterday on Kenya's coast, killing 3 officers. And tensions continue to escalate along the border between Burundi and Rwanda. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. It's been 2 months since Nigeria's president was last seen in public, and there are growing calls for information on the status of his health. Muhammadu Buhari has been in London since May 7th. His office says he's receiving medical treatment for an undisclosed illness. There's no word on when he might return. AFP quotes the head of Nigeria's Center for Democracy and Development as saying, "The government is taking the people for granted." Yadesat Hassan says the president cannot be away for more than 50 days and nobody knows what's wrong. He says the people have a right to know. No photos of President Buhari at the London diplomatic residence has been released. The G20 summit opens tomorrow in Hamburg, Germany, and it could be a contentious meeting. There are clear differences among political leaders on major issues. Among those observing the summit is John Cretton, co-founder of the G20 Research Group. From Hamburg, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the major issues and the battle lines being drawn.
Well, what's properly capturing the attention of the media and publics are the 3 big issues of climate change control, open international trade, and immigration. And these are the issues where the greatest divisions arise, so intense that if the two teams on opposite sides continue on their collision course, this could be the first failed summit that the G20 has ever had amongst the 12 they'll have done by the time Hamburg ends. On the one hand, you've got Donald Trump, who's opposed to immigration, thinks it's bad. On open trade, he thinks they've been bad deals for the United States. He almost ripped up the North American Free Trade Agreement. And on climate change, sometimes he says he doesn't even think it exists and certainly doesn't want to follow Barack Obama in taking measures to control climate change.
So on the opposing team, I assume it's the leaders of Germany and France?
Germany above all. Angela Merkel, as the host, is the most experienced G20 leader, the only one who has been to every other summit since the start. She's also very popular at home and heading into a general election in September, so she has every reason to stand up to Trump, because only about 11% of the German people trust Donald Trump to do the wise thing on issues of international affairs. You have to remember that Angela Merkel is the only G20 host who had previously served as her country's environment minister, so she knows that file at the political level, and she's the only physical or natural scientist who has ever served as G20 host. Macron, yes, he's the new kid on the block with a very passionate pro-European, pro-globalization policy and attitude. The whole new generation, together with Canada's Justin Trudeau, Macron of France joins Macri of Argentina as well, and Moon of South Korea, the new kids on the global governance and G20 block. But really, at the end of the day, it's up to Merkel to get not only her gang together, but to find a way to get Donald Trump on board rather than just staring him down and watching him leave, if not physically, then leaves many of the agreements and the cooperative fora that the world needs the United States to be fully engaged in.
So who's standing with the United States at the G20 summit?
Very few countries, but there's a possibility that if the United States resists any meaningful action on climate change control, that Saudi Arabia, the Russian Federation, and maybe a few others will say, well, we're dependent on fossil fuels, so we're not going to curb our subsidies towards them. We're not going to move to renewable energies. On migration, there's always the possibility that he'll be backed by Theresa May of the United Kingdom, who said, as a matter of policy in her last election, that she wants to reduce the number of immigrants coming into the United Kingdom to tens of thousands from hundreds of thousands as before. And on migration, well, even a number of Merkel's fellow European countries are getting cold feet, including Macron, leaving countries such as Turkey and its President Erdogan to bear a terrible burden of their own. They're, after all, right next door to Syria. But with Erdogan, you never quite know, given his dispute with Angela Merkel, where he's going to come down.
When was the last time you saw a G20 summit this divided?
Never. Amidst the great American-turned-global financial crisis in the autumn of 2008, everyone knew they had to come together with big, bold, decisive actions in order to prevent the world from plunging into a new Great Depression, which, of course, brought Hitler and the Holocaust in its wake. So the spirit of never again, we must come together, was overwhelming, and the disagreements were more about the details. So would it be fiscal stimulus? Would it be stronger financial regulation? Would it be the promise not to engage in protectionism? And what balance would you set? Here, the divides are not how do we go about solving a problem we all know we have. There are fundamental disagreements about what the problem is. Does climate change exist or not? Is open trade harming American workers or helping them? And on the other issue of migration, are migrants actually good for the recipient country's economy, some might even say necessary, or are they basically a terrorist threat that are stealing jobs from the country to which they've come?
That's John Carton, co-founder of the G20 Research Group from Hamburg, Germany. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. A new report finds flourishing tourism in Africa is putting millions of people to work and adding billions of dollars to national economies. The annual Economic Development in Africa report projects continued robust growth in tourism in the coming years. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
Growth figures in Africa's tourism sector are impressive. The World Travel and Tourism Council projects the total contribution of tourism to Africa's gross domestic product will amount to $296 billion by 2026. This is a phenomenal increase, considering that tourism's direct contribution to Africa's GDP was $30 billion between 1995 and 1998. The Tourism Council also expects the sector to generate nearly 29 million jobs in 2026, up from 21 million in 2016. UNCTAD Secretary General Mukisa Kituyi says intra-African tourism, which now exceeds visitors from Europe, the United States, and Asia, is behind the fast growth in the industry.
Also importantly documented in this report is the fact that intra-African tourism is 12 months a year. It does not wait for the northern winter. And that way it underpins more continuing livelihoods than the seasonal tourism associated with traditional forms of source markets.
But Kituyi says African governments must liberalize air transport to realize the potential of intra-regional tourism for the continent's economic growth. Currently, he says, four countries, South Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Kenya, account for more than 90% of air traffic.
Now, many countries which don't have a viable national airline don't see the reason of giving concession to low-cost landing when there is no such benefit for their own airlines. And what it means is that you start finding abnormally high landing costs for airlines from other African countries.
Kituyi says this short-sighted policy results in abnormally high costs for intra-African flying. This, he says, holds back greater potential revenue through the greater movement of persons across the continent. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll review the 29th African Union Summit that was dominated by discussions on war and conflict, but also talks on investing in the African youth. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop.
Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.